Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined today by our good friend Tom Nichols. Hey, good morning, first of all.
Hey, Charlie. Great to be back.
We should promote that you and I are going to be doing something. Your book is coming out. Your book, Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. And you and I are actually going to do an online chat on August 19th about it.
Right? Absolutely. We're going to, unfortunately, due to our current pandemic status, it's got to be online, but it's for Politics and Prose, which, of course, is Washington's premier indie bookstore.
The place.
And, they're going to host us, and we're going to talk about the book and take questions.
Which should be interesting. So just sort of think of it as a lighter, probably less explicit version of the Bulwark Podcast.
With audience participation.
With audience participation. What could possibly go wrong? Okay, here's like an interesting footnote in history that I probably should erase since we're, retconning the past so aggressively. I think probably not the last time I was at Politics and Prose, but the last time that I can remember was back in like 1989 or something like that, maybe 1990, going to a book party for, going to a book party for Dinesh D'Souza.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Sweet mother.
Yeah, I know.
That's crap. That's actually, and I bet it was for Illiberal Education, right. Which wasn't a bad book.
No. And I had written some books about higher education as well. So, we were kind of in that same universe, and I thought it was a supportive thing to do. And,
it's interesting because people always reproach us and say, but how could you have, and we say, well, they weren't felons then. They were, they hadn't lost their minds then.
We didn't know.
And I think, there was a time when the Tuckers and Dinesh's and the, I won't say, Colt or Ingram, but there was a time when a lot of younger conservatives 30 years ago, their role models were Buckley and Will and, intellectual writers. And then they decided that because either through a lack of opportunity and certainly because of a lack of talent, they weren't going to be that. They decided, well, I'll just make money, fleecing the rubes and going for the extremism. And
yeah.
Because that's where the money was.
So sort of like saying, I knew Walter White before the meth lab.
Yeah, he was my science teacher. I loved him.
He was a great guy.
He was a good science teacher. He used to wear hush puppies.
The meth was bad for him. Okay, so we have Tucker Carlson in Hungary. I want to get to that. I want to get to this this soundbite from Cori Bush, which I think that some of our progressive listeners need to talk about, or need to at least listen to us talk about.
Oh my God.
So I'm a dog person. I think you are a notorious cat person. Can you explain the J.D. Vance going off about the cat ladies? This is something he is going off on, and he's done this a couple of times, right? That AOC and Pete Buttigieg are childless cat ladies, and so this is like a thing. What?
Right.
What's with the cat lady thing?
There's some kind of trope in the mists, even beyond my and your conservative, history, something about, that the childless cat ladies are the people, that the Democrats are going to empower, and they're going to take away your schools, and they're going to, make everybody have a small yappy dog or a tiny cat it's just this weird kind of outdated trope that reminds us all that J.D. Vance, that I wasn't wrong when I wrote a piece about J.D. Vance that called him a body part that begins with A, because we never swear on this, but I would never say asshole. But, he's desperate and thirsty, and he's trying to, it's like he's loose at the control board trying to push all the buttons that will somehow make him a senator, that will make the food pellet come out so that he gets to be a senator. And it's just stupid. It's just a silly old trope. But I think the more serious part is when he tries to say, well, all the voters of Ohio, if you don't elect me, you're going to be, you're going to be governed by childless Latinas from New York and drag queens from San Francisco.
It is like kind of Mad Libs, right? I mean, they're just going to try to bring a combination. Exactly. It'll be childless cat ladies, childless, you know, childless drag queen,
cat lady, Latina, something.
Childless leftists. Okay, you know, speaking of this whole childless thing, this is kind of weird because for people who wonder, is it just J.D. Vance in this race too, who could be the stupidest candidate in Ohio, which, by the way, he apparently is losing to Josh Mandel. So Ben Dominic, who is probably best known to our audience as Meghan McCain's husband, thoroughly deplorable founder of The Federalist, and speaking of thirsty, doing gigs on Fox News, he had a riff last night, about how leftists hate children. I mean, I think that the screenshot is why the left hates babies. And so people on social media had to clarify that they did not Photoshop this. This is not a parody. This is Ben Dominic going on Fox News telling people, you know, the one thing that leftists really hate are babies. Let's play the soundbite.
I used to wonder where this weird hatred of boys and girls came from until I became a parent myself last year. And I finally realized progressives hate babies because they are crying, drooling, pooping refutations of everything woke leftists believe. Boys and girls are the answer to the left's every argument and the antidote to their every poisonous lie.
What? Well,
pretty strict, you know, with this is, Tom.
This is where, you know, as you were pointing out, you went to a book event for D'Souza. I mean, I used to work for Ben. I used to write articles for The Federalist. And there was a time, and people aren't going to believe this, but, you know, I will just say again that Ben's a very intelligent guy. He really is. And this was not certainly not the person I knew. And I think the problem is, as it is with everyone in conservative media, there's a ratchet effect that to get ahead of your competitors, you have to say something stupider and crazier than whoever got the last kind of dopamine jolt in the attention economy. So then you say something stupid and crazy, and then someone out crazies you, you know, whether it's Ingraham or Levin or whoever it is. And then you've got to say, well, okay, I want to be in this game. And I think he's just, you know, I think like, I don't think he's that unusual. I think like everybody in conservative media, it's what stupid, crazy thing can I say to keep the eyeballs of scared, you know, whacked out old people glued on me? You know, because when he says they hate your children, to a Fox audience, what he's really saying is they hate your grandchildren.
Yeah. So there are people nodding their heads going, yes, obviously, progressives who run for office, they hate children. They have no children themselves. They were never children themselves. Actually, could you just play this again? Jonathan, could you just play that soundbite again?
I used to wonder where this weird hatred of boys and girls came from.
Hatred.
I became a parent myself last year. And I finally realized progressives hate babies because they are crying, drooling, pooping refutations of everything woke leftists believe. Boys and girls are the answer to the left's every argument and the antidote to their every poisonous lie.
I'm having a hard time. Are you able to chart that out? I thought he was going, they're drooling, pooping examples of what progressives like, right? I mean, the drooling, pooping refutations of, where did that sentence start?
And also, how does suddenly having a baby make that occur to you? I had a baby, you know, 17 years ago, and I don't recall leftists walking up to me and hissing in my face about, you know, if anything, I couldn't tell the politics of people who were, because my daughter was really, really cute and she was an adorable baby. And, you know, I don't remember anybody. I don't even know what this is about
what you said. Yeah, they're going for the pellet. And, you know, he's on Fox and he's thinking, you know, nobody actually knows who I am except that I'm Meghan McCain's husband. So I need to say the most outrageous possible things because maybe I'll go viral and maybe I'll get some of the table scraps from, you know, Tucker's folks. I don't know.
Maybe you'll be talking about him right now.
So speaking of scraps.
Triggering the libs, man. It's lib triggering 101.
So there's Tucker Carlson in Hungary. Just a little bit of background. Hungary is this sort of fascist-adjacent authoritarian regime run by Viktor Orban. There's been this sort of weird fetish of some people on the right about Hungary, which is explicitly illiberal, post-democratic. And you know, for people who think that perhaps you and I have overblown our discussion of the fascist curious right, the articles that appeared in American Greatness, some of the other things where the nostalgia for authoritarianism. And for those of you that think that, oh, come on, guys, these guys aren't really fascist. They are not really that illiberal and authoritarian. There is freaking Tucker Carlson in Hungary sucking up to Viktor Orban. So talk to me about that, because, you know, as Jonathan Chait says, apparently Tucker Carlson has seen the future of the right or the Republican Party, and it's fascist. It's like, okay, you'll understand this, Tom. There's only one thing more annoying than being wrong. It's turning out that you were more right than you thought, which is really annoying because I don't want to be right about this.
You know, we're just talking about Ben and in comparison to Tucker. What Ben is doing is silly, and we can laugh about it, and it's just goofy, and it's fundamentally unserious. What Tucker is doing is serious and dangerous.
Yeah.
He is making common cause with people across the Atlantic who, unfortunately, you know, gotta remember, in theory, Hungary is one of our allies, but, you know, in theory, so is Turkey and a lot of other places. But what he's doing is he's giving top cover to people who are very happy to see a transnational rightist movement tearing apart the United States. And this is incredibly dangerous because, in fact, a lot of the claims about Hungary, the average Tucker viewer has no idea where Hungary is,
right,
or what's going on there. Has no idea. You know, David Frum pointed out that for all of that talk of nationalism and independence, of course, you know, a lot of Hungary's money and well-being is sustained by dragging in money from the hated European Union and NATO.
Welfare queen.
Yeah. Well, it's a very dangerous game. It's an extremely dangerous game, loaded with anti-Semitic, very quiet but nonetheless anti-Semitic dog whistles. Tucker is now trying to play in a league at the international level that I think is dangerous, and I think he's probably in over his head. And again, you know, no one would deny that Tucker Carlson's an intelligent person. But I don't think he quite understands the deep end of the pool he just waded into.
Well, maybe he does, though. See, and that is what makes it scary. So for a little bit of background, Freedom House, which monitors human rights and the state of freedom around the world, notes that Hungary is a state that has dropped any pretense of respecting democratic institutions. Freedom House does not even characterize it as a democracy anymore. And Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine writes, these are not mere details, and Carlson is not overlooking them. He is laying down a marker in the highest profile way that he can that Orban's iron fist is the future the Republican Party should want. The splashy imprimatur of a Fox News primetime personality, who is probably the right's most influential media figure, is an important milestone in the Republican Party's long evolution into authoritarianism. I don't think that's an overstatement. So the question is, I guess, why? You know, okay, the guy's making millions. He's got the buzz. He's got all the influence. What is Tucker? Why would Tucker decide to escalate by going to one of the vilest authoritarian regimes in the world and embracing it? What is the end game here?
What I meant by wandering, you know, into the deep end of the pool is that it seems to me that a lot of guys like Tucker and some of the other American conservatives who are playing this game, for them, it's just all raw material to come back and own the libs and to generate ratings and to, you know, have some great talking points. Again, there's a fundamental lack of seriousness there because these are people that have never really encountered an authoritarian regime. They've never felt endangered personally. They have never, you know, they've never had to sacrifice. They've never had to take any risks in their lives. And so, you know, they've never really been in a place where, you know, they're talking to someone who then has to stop talking to you and walk away from you so that both of you are not arrested.
Yeah.
For simply having a conversation. They don't understand that part of it, and they think this is all a game And they don't really talk to the people who've ever been arrested. They've never seen the inside of one of those places. And so I think, you know, this is all a, as David Frum said about, you know, again, going to quote David Frum twice here, but as Frum once said of Tucker, Tucker likes money and he likes being on TV. And if playing footsie with fascists around the world helps him get money and be on TV, he'll do it. But with he and a lot of the rest of them don't seem to understand that comes the revolution. They're some of the first people who get carted off.
Yeah, I have an image of him playing with the dragons and just assuming that the dragon will not eat him, that the dragon is going to be tame. And so he's feeding the dragon and building up the dragon. And you wonder where this leads. Did you see, by the way, that so Tucker, Rod Dreher, is it Dreher, who is tweeting?
And let me just say, yeah, John, I'm sorry to interrupt, but just say that the when I say comes the revolution, I mean when people that he likes come into power.
Oh, right. No.
They card off people like him, because this has always been the pattern both on the far right and far left, is that you take the people that you were your, you know, supposed enablers, and you get rid of them, because the last thing you want hanging around are the sort of clever intellectuals who got you where you are. You just take those people away. And, you know, this is, I've spent my life, you know, a good part of my life studying authoritarianism. I began my career, for people that don't know, you know, who may be new to the broadcast. You know, I was a Soviet expert. That was how I began my career. And I spent a lot of time in the old Soviet Union and in the briefly democratic Russia, and then again in Putin's Russia. And you know, these guys are playing with fire and they don't even know it and don't care. It ups the ratings and they don't care.
So since you mentioned that, so has the right now moved on from being fanboys of Vladimir Putin to being fanboys of Viktor Orban? Is that, you know, sort of in the background there, that we really admire the strong man, but Putin is a little bit inconvenient. So since nobody knows who Viktor Orban is, we can go to Orban. And again, I was going to quote this Rod Dreher, who's quoting Tucker Carlson. The final good thing about Hungary, says Tucker Carlson, that you are truly hated by all the right people. You know, because it's all about owning the libs. There's no positive agenda. You're hated by all the right people. And so I can embrace you without having all the baggage of the whole Russia Putin thing.
You know, I've had a lot of conversations with Rod Dreher over the years. I actually like him. But, you know, the idea that your politics will boil down to being hated by the right people, it really is kind of the gateway drug to authoritarianism. Of many flavors of authoritarianism, from, you know, fascism to caudilloism. Once you've decided that you stand for nothing and stand against everything, the rest comes easy.
Hey, let's take a quick break, because I want to talk to you about, and we want to have some tough love for some of our progressive friends, including this soundbite from Cori Bush that I want to share with you. I want to talk about the eviction moratorium politics and law, and your piece in The Atlantic, which is an excerpt from your book about the myth of the golden years in the United States. We're talking with author, pundit, cat guy, Tom Nichols. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey, Charlie Sykes here. Just a quick reminder, if you sign up for Bulwark Plus, you will have access to our morning newsletters, to JVL's Triad, as well as our whole suite of podcasts. This one will remain free, but if you want to listen to The Secret Podcast or participate in our live streams or others like The Next Level Podcast, please consider joining Bulwark Plus. Okay, we are back with Tom Nichols. Okay, we've been talking about the crazies on, well, not the crazies on the right. See, I think that's unfair to say crazy, because the Tucker Carlson, the Ben Dominics are not crazy. They know what they are doing.
They know exactly. So does Jaden Vance.
Right. So
they know what they're doing.
So maybe we have to divide this into three buckets. I mean, there are the genuine crazies out there who can be entertaining. Then there's just the complete stupid, which I find exhausting. And then there are the authoritarian, cynical, fascist, curious types who I think are really quite dangerous. And right now, as you point out, they're an alliance that may not last. But they, you know, it's like, it's the, you know, the leopards eating people's faces party. They're just figuring that it will never eat their faces.
You know, I think of them, we throw around the word fascist a lot. And for me, even to use that word, because people know I'm really allergic to that word and I don't like using it unless you have really, you know, good evidence for it. And I think we're getting there. I think, you know, the notion that the Republican Party is basically just becoming a sort of pre or proto fascist organization. But, you know, it's funny. Maybe from years of studying the old Soviets, I think of all these people like Tucker and the Fox lineup and the talk show guys, they are future apparatchiks in the old Soviet sense. These are people who are saying, look, tell me what the party line is. And as long as I stay on the Central Committee's list for an apartment in DC, I'll say it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that this is, I mean, you know, a guy like Vance, what do I need to say to get out of Ohio, you know, to get out of the, you know, Midwestern regional oblast and be sent to the Central Committee block of apartments in DC as a senator? If I have to say it, I'll say it. And there's no sense of right or wrong. It's simply whatever the party line is. And you say that because then you're on the list for an apartment and you get a better car and you can go to the right shops. And to me, that's who these people are. That's what makes them really dangerous, because they are not ideologues. They are not committed to the things they're saying. They are opportunists and self-promoters. And so, in some ways, people like that are more dangerous than fascists. All right, fascists believe in stuff. These people don't.
Well, or fascists, are, you know, may believe in, you know, things like who they really hate. I don't know.
Right.
I guess I think of fascism as less a coherent ideology than more just sort of a strutting posture, kind of almost an aesthetic as opposed to, say, a doctrinaire belief. Am I wrong about that?
No. And I think, you know, if there is a growth of an American version of fascism, it will be the Mussolini variant, you know, that you're kind of talking about, which is, you know, it has no, I mean, one of the things that bothers me when people talk about fascism, if you think of hard right regimes like the Nazis and, you know, the fascist movements that were around in Western Europe, they had highly articulated platforms. They actually, you know, there was actually like a line that they all followed. I think you're right that this is more like, this will be strutting and jutting, you know, like, I mean, every time I saw Trump, I thought, wow, this is like a bad Mussolini impression. But you know, that works too. That riles up the rubes and, you know, makes them shout and wave their pretty colored flags. You know, that it's no less dangerous to democracy in that sense. But it's just harder for them to consolidate and to organize with each other, because they, you know, half of them don't know what they're talking about and the other half don't really believe in it.
All right, let's flip the script a little bit here. Trigger warning for some of our progressives. Some tough love is on the way here. Cori Bush is a Democratic congresswoman from Colorado. She led the sit-in on the Capitol steps pushing for the eviction moratorium. I want to set that aside for a moment. So she's been in the news a lot. This soundbite is getting a lot of attention. And I know you tweeted about it. I tweeted about it. And the reason why I want to highlight it is because this is the kind of thing that could really torpedo Democrats in the midterm elections and going forward. And if you don't recognize the cognitive dissonance / complete hypocrisy of this, then we need to talk. So again, this is Cori Bush. And you may have seen this tweet out there. It summarizes saying that, you know, I'm going to pay for private security for myself, but I favor abolishing the police. That looks, at least on the surface, when I first saw that, I thought, well, that's probably an unfair paraphrase. Actually, it's pretty much exactly what she says. Let's play this soundbite from Congressman Cori Bush.
The thing, I won't let them get that off. You can't get that off. I'm going to make sure I have security, because I know I have had attempts on my life and I have too much work to do. There are too many people that need help right now for me to allow that. So if I end up spending $200,000, if I spend $10 more dollars on it, you know what? I get to be here to do the work. So suck it up, and defunding the police has to happen. Right. We need to defund the police and put that money into social safety nets.
Okay, Tom, Geez. There she is in the same interview talking about how she is prepared to spend $200,000 on her own personal safety, but she's still using the phrase defund the police. Look, I mean, at the most cynical level, that doesn't strike me as a terribly appealing political message.
You know, Jesus jumping Christ. What do you even say about a, what do you even say about a, you know, I, like you, when this thing first broke, I said, well, this is the usual hit job. They're probably taking her out of context, you know, and then I watched the, this is one of the few cases where when I watched the clip, it's worse than the original report when you actually watch it.
Yeah.
And underlying it is a, is exactly, you know, I was talking about the, well, as long as I get to be in DC, right? And slagging our old conservative friends. This is exactly the same mindset. I am simply too important to risk, people. I have important things to do. So if I spend money on my security, that lets me be here in Washington to do important things for you. And you little people are just going to have to suffer, you know, living in your neighborhoods. This might be, I mean, this is going to go on the wall with deplorables and the 49% and, you know, stupid things that you should never say. First of all, you shouldn't think them at all, but you if that thought passes through your head, it's certainly not a thought you ever needed to express. And I think that this is, you know, to take the old line from Rick Wilson, they are holistically bad at politics. And there's one other thing that I think is really important to point out, Charlie, because I think people, a lot of our progressive friends always say, well, what difference does it make really? You know, she's one candidate. What Democrats refuse to understand and embrace is that every candidate is now a national candidate. Every race is a national race. American elections, and this is really a poisonous thing, but it's unavoidable in an era of social media and 24-hour news. Every race is a national race. Cori Bush just made life incredibly difficult for a bunch of sensible, centrist Democrats in purple districts across the United States. And this is where the Democrats simply have no message, discipline. Somebody in the Democratic Party should have been on the phone 10 minutes later saying, okay, you know, we need to talk right now. You know, the day after they defeat Nina Turner.
Exactly. See, this is what makes this so frustrating. Jesus. I think what ought to, because, you know, two things happen. I mean, you have Nina Turner, who was the far left candidate running for Congress, was defeated by Chantel Brown. I mean, this was really a big victory for the more moderate Democratic wing. It's certainly a sign the Democrats recognize how toxic somebody like a Nina Turner would be. But then you have Cori Bush saying, okay, but still, you know, if you Republicans are looking for a face you want to put on the party, here I am talking about spending $200,000 on myself, but cutting police for you. You know, put also this in the context of Eric Adams winning the Democratic primary for New York City mayor. He ran on a very sort of, pro law and order plank, and he defeated the candidates that were had associated themselves with defund the police, because low income people in New York are looking around going, no, you folks that live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan may think it's cool to play around with ideas like defunding police, but I want a cop, you know, when I get on the subway. I want a cop when I go down to the, to the grocery store, all of those things. So, you know, Democrats do seem to get it, you know.
You and I having, you know, spent some time and, you know, you especially, but, you know, having spend some time in Republican politics, we can assure progressive listeners that right now there are people at Republican Party HQ with that clip
weaponizing it
and figuring out what to do with it. And, you know, I'm sorry, but when people say, well, Republicans will slam us anyway and they'll smear us, you know, don't help them. Don't hand them the ammunition. Don't make that job so easy that it's, you know, I used to say to friends when I was a Republican, they'd say, well, you Republicans just steal elections and you cheat and you do all, I'm like, no, but most Republican elections are won by default. That Democrats either don't show up or they run somebody who is so, you know, abjectly incompetent that simply putting an R next to somebody's name does it. This is another one of those cases where it's just a complete gift handed to Republicans who can then say Democrats are hypocrites. They'll protect themselves. They'll, you know, have security for themselves. This is really one of the most shockingly dumb things I've ever seen happen in American politics.
It is, because, you know, Democrats all around the country are going, no, we don't favor defunding the police. No, that's not us. No, and in fact, right now, we are the ones who are backing the blue. We, in fact, are standing with law enforcement. And so what does Cori Bush come out and do and say, no, wait, the worst caricature you could possibly draw on Fox News, I'm going to become that person. I'm going to say it.
I think Democrats have, you know, recaptured some ground that they lost a lot of years ago by saying, look, we are you. We are the ordinary people like you. The Republicans are. And I think, you know, this is one of the saddest exchanges of roles that I, as a former Republican, I mean, when I was a kid in the 80s, I felt like the Republicans were the party of kind of ordinary people and working folks. Yep. And the Democrats had become these kind of out of touch elitists. And then here's a Democrat stepping forward and saying, listen, if I have to spend $200,000 on my very important self so that I can come to Washington, well, you have to do without the police. You know, the party demands sacrifices, comrade.
All right.
And it's just unbelievable.
So one of the reasons why Cori Bush is so prominent right now is because she led the campaign to extend the moratorium on evictions, which had been decreed by the CDC. And this has been a very, very strange week, because you have the U.S. Supreme Court and other federal courts who basically said, yes, this exceeds your statutory authority. The CDC cannot simply decree that landlords cannot evict people. I mean, there are property rights issues. I mean, they are people too, believe it or not. But also, if you want to continue this moratorium, you have to have congressional action. Well, Congress doesn't act. There's no congressional action. The court has made it clear the CDC does not have the power. So you have this weird moment where you have President Biden previewing the fact that his administration is about to extend this moratorium and admitting very explicitly it's probably going to be thrown out by the courts. I can't recall a moment where you had a president saying, yes, I'm going to do something. It's illegal, but at least, you know, we'll have some time before the courts bust us on all of this. And all of this was to appease the left wing of his party. It was, you know, I have to admit, you know, Tom, we've spent the last 5 years talking about the rule of law, about norms, about the Constitution, and they really ought to matter even when it comes to progressive agendas. Like, I don't want to see people evicted either, but I also don't want the president saying, yeah, I'm about to do something that is unconstitutional and illegal, and because I want to, and everybody going, oh, this is just so great. This is so fantastic.
And one of the problems that the Democrats have always had is that they think that when they win an election, they're never going to lose an election, and that anything they've done will not be precedent. And, you know, I brought this up back. I mean, I think as a good conservative for years, I've been an opponent of excessive affirmative executive orders. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of affirmation of executive power that I think goes too far constantly, that both parties have affirmed over and over again to their detriment. And, you know, but I tried to tell this to Democrats when President Obama said, I have a pen and a phone.
Yep.
Well, okay, a Republican president's going to walk in and say, hey, look at that. Same pen, same phones right here. It's amazing. Anybody who has this desk gets this pen and this phone. You know, and this excessive deference and this excessive affirmation of the need for executive power, the Democrats are answering and they're saying, okay, but Congress wouldn't do it and someone has to, so the president does. Well, first of all, that's not how the Constitution works. Right. That's not how a system of separated powers works. And if Congress isn't doing its job, then you have to get on Congress. The president cannot just constantly step in and fix it whenever Congress isn't doing something. I mean, Trump made that argument. This is the part that, you know, is really shocking. Biden is making the same argument Donald Trump used to make.
Yes.
Congress wouldn't do it, so I have to. And I know it's probably illegal, but what are you going to do? Now, the Democrats, I can hear the howling before we've even aired this, but Trump was trying to overturn the government and Biden is just trying to protect poor people.
Right.
And that's true. That, you know, to say one violation of the law is not, does not have the same incredible, you know, evil intent that the other one does, but that doesn't change the fact that it's a violation of the law. And you don't get the Constitution doesn't have a, but it's a nice thing to do disclaimer if you want to violate the Constitution.
Well, I would also put it in another term, that we've been talking about fascism and authoritarianism. Every time the federal government claims the power that, you know, if we simply declare an emergency or if we simply invoke this, therefore we suddenly have these vast powers to control the economy or to control individual choices, understand that that can be flipped as well. And so right now it may be virtuous exercise of power. But again, this is something that conservatives have been arguing for some time. You know, the government that is, what is that quote, you know, the government is big enough to do everything for you, is big enough to take everything from you or do all kinds of bad things as well. So keep in mind, how do you feel about a second Trump administration declaring a health emergency, which then gives them the power to do X, Y, and Z, because that's the way it works when you establish these precedents, which is why it is good to restrain government, to follow the rule of law, and to take the system of checks and balances seriously when you're in power, because the other guy is going to be in power at some point, and that can be genuinely frightening.
Let me put it this way to Democrats and steal a lyric from an old song. Anything Democrats can do, Republicans can do better. Mm. And they will do it for a far worse reason. Once you establish these precedents, Republicans will tent their fingers like Monty Burns and say, excellent. And then they will use them. And I know the arguments that Democrats are going to make. They're going to say, why do we always have to follow the rules? Why do we always have to be the ones observing the norms? Why do we? Because you are the ones that want to be the governing party and the protectors of the Constitution. And if you want to continue to be that party, you're just going to have to be, you know, you're going to have to be better than your opponents. And I think they are. I mean, I think I don't want anybody certainly not listening to me, to think that, you know, it's like, wow, the Democrats have become as bad as the Republicans. I don't think either of us are saying that. I think what we're saying is Democrats, don't step into these bear traps that the Republicans will happily trigger and then later use for far more nefarious, far more dangerous purposes than anything you're doing right now. It's not that Cori Bush is going to, you know, take over the government and make the police go away. And it's not that Joe Biden is going to become an American Caesar. It's that when you're setting up these precedents and you're behaving this way, you're rationalizing and legitimating the Republicans who will inevitably come after you to do things in that same, for those same reasons and for much more terrifying purposes.
I agree. You're having kind of a big day today. Your book is coming out, Our Own Worst Enemy. I just want to remind people about the event on August 19th, which you can sign up for. Also, The Atlantic has excerpted the book. You can find this online at The Atlantic. The Myth of the Golden Years, Whether Economic Times Are Good or Bad, The Lament for the Old Days of Factories and Mills Never Changes. This is an interesting point because, of course, at the heart of this populist critique of American democracy is they looking around, seeing the American carnage, you know, people, you know, dying, you know, being unemployed, and saying this is an example of, this is the result of the failure of liberal democracy. And what you point out is that central to this criticism is this nostalgia for an idealized past that always makes the present seem terrible. Some of this manipulation comes from political charlatans, but sincere concerns come from some political and economic elites, especially those who are products of a class transition and advancement through education and relocation. So just talk for a moment, and I know we'll spend more time talking about your book later, but This power of the myth of the golden years, that there was this idealized past and that we need to take America back. And if we had just did not have all of these, you know, these liberal democratic failures, and by the way, those are all, you know, small L, small D failures, that things would be so much, you know, better for all of us. Didn't Was there? Yeah, wasn't there a golden age in America?
No. Yeah. And you know, what people are thinking they remember is the period from about 1945 to 1960, where, you know, the world was in ruins. America was the unchallenged, you know, leader of a capitalist economy where, you know, we had geared up for World War II. There were a lot of manufacturing, you know, aerospace, in California, you know, building all those tract homes. But that was a kind of unique blip in world history. And when people talk about, well, you know, Donald Trump really was a response. The Republican Party today is a response to the forgotten towns. A couple of things that are so wrong with this. First of all, my town, the one I wrote about in the piece, all of that industrial decline was basically complete by about 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this notion that somehow like the Chinese swept in and destroyed all these towns, I mean, that was a big economic theory in the early 2000s, and that's already starting to fall apart because it turns out that the 2000s weren't as bad as people thought they were. And the data just isn't there. It's a perception, but it's not a reality. The reality is people have been looking at empty factories for a long time. And I'll just tell you a quick story. One of my best friends from my hometown, he had voted for Trump, and he was complaining about, you know, the state of everything. And he pointed at the factories and he said, those factories, you know, my restaurant used to be full with workers. And I just looked at him for a minute and I said, you and I broke the windows in that empty factory in the early 1970s. That factory has not been full in any time that you can remember. And he just kind of blinked for a moment because he had kind of come to this fantasy that factory in his memory was this, you know, happy workers with newsboy caps and, you know, sitting and eating their sandwiches on a girder and everything. That factory was empty when we were 11 in the early 1970s. And that nostalgia has been sold over and over and over again. You know, Youngstown, I mentioned in the book, the people who talk about the day the big Youngstown mill closed. I went back and did the math. That mill closed 44 years ago. Now, I'm sorry, but if you worked there and you were put out of work, if you can remember that, you're pretty old.
But this myth has a fierce grip, fierce grip on the public imagination. It was central to Trump's appeal and to this populist appeal, the J.D. Vance appeal.
Well, when people say, you know, the factories are all gone and we need them back, I always turn and I say, have you ever been in a factory? Have you ever walked into one of these buildings when it was, because I had, my mom worked for a company that, you know, made paper, which is still there. You know, people who say, we need these factory jobs back. I always want to say, why? So that immigrants can work them? Because you won't. Trust me that you are not going to work these jobs because that tells me you've never been inside a factory. But they say, but in 1970, you know, Archie Bunker could afford his own house in Queens. Well, yeah, because he didn't have to compete with women and black people. And, you know, that was a whole different time. If you really want to live, the conservative writer Kevin Williamson has this great line. He says, if you really want to live like it's 1957, that lifestyle is available to you and very cheap. The problem is that when people remember these things, they don't remember all the other stuff that goes with it. It's like, I wish it were 1960 again, but with civil rights and air conditioning and 180 channels and internet porn and gambling. And, you know, people forget that they would not want to live the way their parents lived at their age. You know, well, college was cheaper. Yes. And no one went to college. This is the other thing. Well, college was cheaper in 1970. And a small handful of men went to college. Almost nobody else went. But when I started college in 1979, only about 13 or 14% of American women went to college. So if that's the better time, have at it.
You know, it is interesting. You know, we don't have enough time to get into it. But I mean, you know, listening to you, I'm thinking about some of the things that were written and said before our current, before this particular crisis that we're embroiled in right now, that really life has improved so dramatically by any measure that we are living. We're living longer, we're living healthier, we have more prosperity, we have more choices. So the real paradox of America right now is, why are we not happier?
We're not happy because we are, we've gotten used to a high standard of living and it bores us.
It bores us.
Even the poorest among us, you know, I won't say the very poorest. I mean, there are people still in Appalachia, you know, living without running water. But even the working poor that once, you know, were part of this giant debate about what to do about poverty, people, the average American home has between 2 and 3 televisions in it. I mean, this is just these kind of small little factoids that kind of blow my mind that people say, yeah, but that doesn't really mean anything. No, actually, you know, it means a lot. I mean, the idea that you're living now, to compare your living standard now to within your living memory, say to 1980, would be dramatic. And people have just gotten used to it and they're bored. They want meaning in their life. They want big drama in their life. They want everything to be interesting. You know, we have created a culture where everybody feels that like their work and their life has to be, you know, everything they've ever seen in the movies. And that is going to kill us, because when you spend all day stewing in a sense of relative deprivation and resentment, then you will always come to the conclusion that someone has screwed you, and it's probably the government, and that means democracy's got to go.
So you and I will talk about this much more in detail over the next coming weeks. The book is coming out. When is the pub date on the book?
August 19th. It's the drops the day you and I go on go to Politics and Prose.
I got it in the mail yesterday, just so you know. I'm holding it in my hand. Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy by Tom Nichols, published by Oxford University Press. Tom, thanks for coming on the podcast again. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.